Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is David Vann, whose latest book, a novel, is Caribou Island. Earlier book is A Mile Down, The True Story of a Disastrous Career at Sea, also the author of Legend of a Suicide, which contains a novella, Sukwan Island, which has been reprinted separately and is actually available for free download from Amazon right now. David Vann grew up in Alaska and Northern California, works as an associate professor at University of San Francisco, and has also been the owner and operator of a tour boat in the Mediterranean and Caribbean. We'll talk all about that. David Vann, this novel is a continuation of an examination of your earlier life, which included a father who committed suicide and a stepmother whose parents died in a murder-suicide. And it seems that you're reusing material and names, but in these various stories, in these various fictions, while the characters' names are the same and the backgrounds are similar, this isn't a connected thing at all. They're each separate.
That's right. Caribou Island is about a marriage set in Alaska. It's a marriage going wrong in the wilderness. And Legend of a Suicide was about a father-son relationship. In Legend of a Suicide, I was trying to understand my father's suicide when I was 13 and all the effects of that. But in Caribou Island, I go back to a story that happened 11 months before my dad's suicide, when my stepmother lost her parents to murder-suicide.
Was your father and stepmother still married at the time of the murder-suicide?
No, they had divorced. My dad broke up both of his marriages through infidelity, but he was trying to get back together with my stepmother. And he killed himself while talking on the phone with her and said, "I love you, but I'm not going to live without you." She was finally moving on and had found another guy. And she also had told him, "Please don't do this to me." She had just gone through the murder-suicide of her parents. But he went ahead and killed himself while talking on the phone with her. And he sent her flowers, which she received 3 days later on her birthday. So at the time, it all seemed cruel and shameful. And so for 3 years, I told everyone that my father died of cancer, because it was just such an awful kind of event. Now that I have more years and have more sympathy in looking at my father, I can see that he was really suffering and he wasn't thinking clearly. And it doesn't seem as much a cruel act as much as an out of control and suffering kind of thing that he was doing.
Well, Sukwan Island kind of serves almost as a prequel in a weird way to Caribou Island. Your father had invited you to spend a year with him in Fairbanks, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, I was born in Alaska on Adak Island and then grew up in Ketchikan in southeast Alaska, where it's rainforest and really beautiful. And I had gone back all of my vacations to spend time with my father there after my parents divorced and I moved to California with my mother and sister. But then my father asked me to come spend a year back in Alaska with him, a school year, which would have been eighth grade in Fairbanks. And I said no. And 2 weeks later is when he killed himself. So I felt really guilty afterward, and I wondered if I had said yes, if he would maybe still be alive. And so when I wrote Sukwan Island, the short novel within Legend of a Suicide, I wasn't thinking of what I was doing, really. It was very unconscious and out of control. But years later, I could see that what I was really doing in that story was having the boy say yes. The boy goes and spends a year homesteading with his father on an island in southeast Alaska. So it was the boy saying yes. I was going back in time and doing what I hadn't done in real life.
He didn't say, "Let's go homesteading." I mean, that wasn't part of it. You were just going to live with him, right?
Right. I was just going to live with him in Fairbanks. But it felt a little like homesteading in that I was afraid of the place. The kids I knew there in junior high were already into drugs and crime and sex, and it felt a little bit like the Wild West and the frontier up there. I just thought I would miss my friends and everything I had going in California. And I was also afraid of my father and his despair, which was building at that point. He was becoming something I didn't really quite understand. You know, he'd suddenly cry at strange times, and things weren't going well for him. So I think I was just afraid to spend that year. And so that's part of the pressure that's put on the boy in Sukwan Island as they go homesteading for that year, that he ends up starting to take care of his father, and his father isn't really such a great parent. And I think some of my fears about what that year would have been like are in that novella.
Well, when did you start writing Sukwan Island?
I wrote Legend of a Suicide, the entire book about my father and his suicide, for 10 years from when I was 19 until I was 29. And I had to throw away everything from the first 3 or 4 years because there was too much emotion on the first page, and I hadn't figured out how to get any kind of emotional distance. And it was also really confusing to try to figure out how to tell the story because everyone in my family had a different version of who my dad was, what happened, and what it meant. And so none of it came together, and there wasn't one true story. So it took a while to figure out how to tell it. And then the pieces that I kept for the book came quickly. The first story, Ichthyology, I actually wrote at 3 a.m. one night after telling jokes to my roommates and then finished it the next day when I got up. And Tsukwan Island, I wrote half of it in my first offshore sailing trip from California to Hawaii in 17 days of sailing offshore. I wrote about half of it. So the writing came really quickly, but over a 10-year span of being confused and trying to figure out what to do and how to tell stories about him. And in the end, Tsukwan Island is a short novel framed by 5 stories. And that framing and having the 6 pieces working together in conversation with each other form a kind of debate which tell, in my mind, the truer story of what happened with my dad. It took competing points of view to tell the story. I couldn't come up with just one narrative.
Well, were you always thinking of this as a book you were going to sell even from the beginning as opposed to, say, just working out your own details?
I had a mentor at Stanford, John Lehrer, who was great, and he definitely had me never thinking about the commerce of writing. There never was the thought of trying to do something that would be likely to sell. I was just trying to do my best writing and trying to find the story and do something that was real. And so it turned out to be something that was really not publishable and not commercial. For 12 years, no agent would send it to editors. And it was partly the title, Legend of a Suicide, because it had suicide in it, and partly that strange form of a short novel framed by 5 stories. So my life changed completely by the fact that I couldn't get it published. Instead of going on and becoming a professor, which is what I thought I would do, I ended up going to sea and becoming a captain on a boat for years because I couldn't get my book published, and so I couldn't move on in my teaching career either.
David Vann, you never went to Tsukwan Island, but you had said that you wanted it to be a fantasy place. Did you ever go there?
I haven't, and I don't think I ever will go to Tsukwan Island. I wanted it to be a landscape of imagination. I wanted nothing to be incidental. I didn't want a trail to go a certain direction just because it does in real life, or a bay to be shaped the way it is because that's the way it really is. I wanted everything about that island to be a reflection of the boy and his father, of what's going on inside of them, so that the island is an external part of them. It's 50 miles away from Ketchikan, and so I know what the forest would look like and what the water would be like, and I can describe the place, and it's a place still mythic from my imagination, Ketchikan, but I just moved it 50 miles over so that I'd be free from anything that I'd actually seen.
What I found interesting in Caribou Island and your life story was just going up on Yahoo Maps and finding out where everything is.
Yeah.
Adak Island is on the Aleutians. It's in the middle of nowhere. What were your parents doing there?
My dad was a dentist in the Navy for 2 years in the 60s, so he was just fulfilling his military service. Adak is really far out there. It's when the Aleutian Islands are curving down. They're starting to head back up toward Russia. It's right about there. And there's nothing there. My whole birthplace was for sale recently, actually. The town and the port and the base and,
really?
And the National Forest, which is a collection of a dozen trees about 3 feet high because they're 100-mile-an-hour winds every day.
And what prompted them to go to Ketchikan at that point?
Well, my dad always liked to hunt and fish. He didn't really want to be a dentist. So he just moved all around Alaska to hunt and fish in new places. And Ketchikan was fantastic for salmon and halibut and other fishing. So that's the main reason we were there.
Let's skip ahead for a second. You did this long trip. You got married. You and your wife went on these adventures, starting with a 48-foot boat and winding up with a 90-foot, which sunk in the Caribbean. During that period, you were writing A Mile Down, the true story of a disastrous career at sea, which at that point you assumed, I guess, would be just your memoirs of travels, right?
It was actually supposed to be a story about how everything worked out well and we were living the good life in the Caribbean. And then we sank in a freak storm on our honeymoon and lost everything. And so it became a somewhat different story, easier to sell.
Did you have an agent at that point? Or you were just...
I did. I had agents this whole time, and just no one would send out Legend of a Suicide. And A Mile Down, I don't think they would have sent out if it had been a story about the good life.
Were there any short stories, anything that you did sell in the process during that period?
I had stories in the early 90s. My first short story, Ichthyology, which is the beginning of Legend of a Suicide, was published in the Atlantic Monthly. And so I was really lucky with that. That was wonderful. Great place to start. And I had a few other stories win some fiction contests in the early 90s. And then I didn't publish anything for 10 years. I didn't have a single thing anywhere, no story, no essay. I thought I would never be a writer again. I thought I would never get back into university. I thought I'd thrown away my life on the boat disasters. And I was filled with a lot of regret, which my wife had to hear me whine on about.
What was her position on this? What was her?
Well, she had never known me as a writer. When she met me, it was just as I was going into the boat business. And so it sounded like just a big lie to her, this whole thing about writing. She didn't really believe it, that I'd ever done it or ever would do it again.
Well, didn't she see that at Landit Monthly? Didn't you kind of go, here?
Yeah, but I guess it just seemed like old history at that point, like who I'd been before. And that happens in a lot of people's lives. You become someone else, and sometimes you never get to cross back into who you had been before. And so I've been really fortunate. I've had a lot of second chances and gotten to go back to the life that I prefer.
David Vann, let's talk about Caribou Island. At what point did you conceive of it?
I started Caribou Island 14 years ago, right when I finished Legend of a Suicide. When I was 30 years old, I started Caribou Island, and I'm 44 now. At 30, I couldn't figure out how to write it. I could only get 50 pages in, and then I would just stop because I couldn't see how to write a longer arc. It just didn't seem possible, and especially multiple points of view. I couldn't figure out how to do that. And I also didn't know whose story it was. I was just really confused. So I knew there was an important story to tell there and that I wanted to do something based on my stepmother's parents' murder-suicide, but I couldn't figure out how to do it. And so it was in 2009, at the beginning of the year, after Legend of Suicide had come out, that I suddenly could see how to write Caribou Island. And then it happened really quickly. I wrote it in 5.5 months of working every day, 7 days a week, and there was a lot of momentum, and it just felt like being on a freight train. It was wonderful.
You also, in research, you did research on fishing. Now, building the cabin, I guess, some of that research could have come when you were working on Suquan Island as well, I guess.
Yeah, I never actually did any cabin research. I did go back to Alaska and go to all the places where Caribou Island is set. It was the summer of 2009. While I was working on Caribou Island, I went up there for a couple weeks and went out on a commercial fishing boat, worked a slime line and cannery, went for hikes and visited everything. But the cabin, I've actually never built a cabin or spent time in a log cabin, but I've built boats, and I've been a failure at building boats, and I've been impatient and not had designs or plans, no advice welcome, no permits. So Gary, in the book, is building a cabin the way I would build a cabin. I would fail in that same way that he fails.
Switching gears for a second, yesterday when we were chatting, you mentioned that a metal piece of your boat had fallen off during a storm, and it went down the next day. Had you built that boat?
No. Luckily, I had not built that boat. That boat was built in Turkey, and it actually wasn't the Turks' fault either, the rudder that came off. It was a new rudder put on in Spain by the Spanish and Gibraltarians, and they hadn't reinforced the floor of the boat. But it was really the storm we hit. The storm was extreme, and it was worse than the perfect storm and much faster. And in just 1 hour, it went from flat calm, where it was a glassy surface and we could see the tracks of the flying fish, to 30-foot seas coming from a range of directions, very sharp, and then seas twice as high mixed in, waves that were at least 60 feet. And with a 90-foot, 200,000-pound boat, we actually went up on a wave and fell off of it through the air and buried into another wave, popped out backwards like a cork, and then were hit broadside so hard we were picked up and dropped again, and that's what cracked through half-inch steel plate. So it's really not the builder's fault either that happened. I mean, it was just a really horrific storm. It was incredible. I've never been in anything else like it. And so over a day and a half, we ended up sinking as that crack worked itself open. But we sank on kind of a nice day. So on my website at davidvann.com, you can see photos of the sinking, and you wonder, like, what a jerk. How could he sink on a day like that? And it's because we had been in a really horrific storm, and the crack had worked itself open over that time.
Well, you said that when it began working itself open, suddenly the boat began spinning, and your wife, she had been downstairs. She came up. She went back down, grabbed whatever she could, except for the passports, which were in your pants pocket the other end of the boat.
Yeah, most of our stuff was at the end of this long, slippery hallway at that point because it was filled with water. And my wife would have died if she'd gone for our passport, so I'm glad she didn't. But what I love her for is that she rescued the backup disc that had the first 70 pages of A Mile Down. And that's her number one priority item that she grabbed, and you got to love her for that. That's great.
Well, what happened after it went down? Did you guys just fly back to Santa Rosa?
We came back to Fremont, where her parents are, and her parents put us up for the next couple of years because we had no money and no jobs, and the insurance didn't pay for a long time. I had no prospects. I actually wore the same sweater every day for a year while I was working on A Mile Down, and it was a pretty grim time. I'd had knee surgery and had tendonitis afterwards, so I couldn't do stairs, and I'd just kind of limp around the neighborhood and grouch and growl, and she had to put up with that for a while. So we really hit bottom then. I mean, we really had nothing at that point, and that was 2001, 2002. We had nothing at all.
Well, what happened between 2002 and 2009 then?
In 2005, A Mile Down came out, and that was great to go on tour for that. It was my second book that I wrote, but the first book published. The most exciting thing was in 2008 to have Legend of a Suicide come out. I thought it would never be published. No agent would send it to editors, but I sent it to a contest, the Grace Paley Prize, and I just got lucky, and it won that. So it came out with the University of Massachusetts Press, and that probably would have just been ignored, but the New York Times was really generous and gave it a good review, and that changed my life completely. That got HarperCollins, the bigger publisher, interested, who's now come out with Caribou Island, and publishers in 15 languages, foreign publishers.
When did you get the job at the University of San Francisco?
First, I got a job at Florida State based on A Mile Down, and it was a job in creative nonfiction, and taught there for 3 years, and then came to University of San Francisco, and I'm now in my second year there. I'm the nonfiction genre coordinator in their MFA in writing program, and I also teach fiction.
Both Caribou Island and Sukwana Island have something in common in terms of breaking rules. The rule you break in Sukwana Island, which is a key to the story, which we can't really talk about here, it's one of those stories where the entire perspective shifts halfway, so much so that it's almost like jumping off a cliff.
Yeah, it is, and it was an enormous surprise. I was halfway through writing the sentence and then suddenly realized what was going to happen, and I was just shocked because it changed everything about Sukwana Island, and it meant that all my plans were destroyed. Everything that I thought I was writing toward was undone. And so I went back the next day and planned to cut that and just continue on with my plans. But as I read through all the pages leading up to it, I could see that that was inevitable. It's what had to happen. And that's what I really love about fiction, is that it takes over and is unconscious and out of control in that way. And there's pattern that develops that's not what I planned, because my plans aren't very good and my ideas aren't very good. And I now really distrust ideas as a writer. I think an idea is the worst thing that can happen to a writer, and I try not to have them.
Well, what do you mean by an idea?
An idea is that it'd be cool if the book heads in this direction, or the book is about this, I'm writing about this great topic. Like, all those things I think are just garbage. I think the only thing that I can write toward is place or character. If I return to the place and describe it, or I describe the character, that works out. But if I have an idea for a story or what's going to happen or the significance of what I'm writing about or that it's somehow great in some way, all of that has been garbage and I've had to throw it away.
Well, in Caribou Island, the point that I was going to make was the switching of POVs, point of view characters, even within scenes,
right,
which we see in badly written science fiction, but we don't necessarily see it in literary fiction. And it is rule-breaking. But the other element is what you just said, which is that Caribou Island was going to lead to the murder-suicide. So on some level, you did have an idea that you stuck with.
Well, it wasn't an idea as much as it was just a true family story in the background. And I was trying to understand how my stepmother's mother could get to the point where she'd be willing to kill her husband. Because in her suicide notes, she wrote a suicide note to him. She hadn't planned to kill him. It was just a last-minute thing that she decided, you know, she had her plans change, almost like writing a book. She shifted course there at the end, and that was always a mystery to me ever since I was 11 when it happened. Why did she decide to kill him and not just kill herself? And so I was just trying to understand that, and I didn't actually know where the book would end, if it would end up at that point or if it end up somewhere else. And there's a lot of difference between Caribou Island and the true story. It's set in Alaska instead of California. I didn't really know her parents, so the characters aren't them. There are no guns. There had been, you know, it had all been done by guns in real life. So there's a lot that's changed and shifted, and it really was just place and character I was going after, and I didn't know exactly where we would end up.
Well, we've also got that odd link of the homesteading idea, which occurs in both, and mm-hmm. and I think when you read them, there are these odd parallels, mm-hmm. sentences that burst out, and you're kind of going, what's going on in David Van's mind? For instance, in Sukwan Island, we have a father with terrible sinus headaches. And in Caribou Island, we have the mother, Irene, with terrible headaches that are probably sinus-based.
Yeah, and that's because my dad had sinus headaches in real life. So in Legend of a Suicide, I was trying to understand some of the pain he felt at the end, because it was part of his suicide, that this pain was out of control, and it was part of his despair at the end. But then I myself had these awful sinus headaches and surgeries. I had 2 years of year-long headaches, 1 year each time, and it really made me kind of crazy. And in Caribou Island, it's not clear what the source is of the pain, because it's also stress about her life and the fact that a 30-year marriage is falling apart and that her life hasn't gone where she wanted it to go, and that who she is now, she can't get to match up with who she was 5 years ago or 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and she can't make a story of her life that will make sense of it. So she has a lot of problems that are building up. She's just retired and she misses being in the classroom. Her children are adults and she doesn't see them as much anymore. Gary, her husband, has her going out to this island to build a cabin, and she thinks that it's a step toward leaving her, that he'll make this impossible situation so that he can call the marriage impossible and leave. So there's a lot going on, and it's not just a sinus headache for her. But I do use the stuff from my real life, and the things that have put pressure on me, I tend to use to put pressure on the characters, because I think that's what fiction does, is it just puts a lot of pressure on characters in a short space of time. And I think that's what's great about Wilderness, is that these two characters are out there, and there's no distractions, and they can't get away. And the wilderness is just a bare stage with mirrors all around, essentially, and there's just enormous pressure put on them.
In both stories.
Right, in Sukwan Island and in Caribou Island.
Yeah.
I wanted to say something, too, about the point of view shifting, because right. That was another unconscious thing. I had no idea that I would be writing from the point of view of a woman, that Irene would be the main character of Caribou Island. I hadn't planned that. I also didn't know it was going to be about marriage. That was a big surprise to me. All the different seven points of view, everyone reflects on marriage, and I just didn't know that that was coming. And I also didn't know that I'd have so many points of view and there'd be so much switching around. And I never think about it. I actually never think about point of view. It just was necessary. I needed Rhoda's part of the story, their daughter, and so it was just natural to shift into her point of view. And there are actually a lot of writers who have done that for a long time. Muriel Spark and Memento Mori, for instance, at the opening, is wonderful for point of view switching in and out between the characters within a scene many times back and forth. And so I don't know what happened in creative writing programs, that idea that you're not supposed to switch point of views. It's just another one of those silly ideas that arose in creative writing programs, trying to make rules for something that can't be ruled. You know, because the truth is that people have always switched point of view, and it's always been fine to do that. And I think most writers don't really think about it. I think it's only in creative writing workshops that we think it's important to think about it.
You've said that rather than looking at novels as the source of your inspiration, you look at drama.
Yeah, I've read a lot of plays, and for Caribou Island, I think of the structure as the structure of a play. It has a limited cast of characters, and it's a pitched battle between Gary and Irene, the couple, leavened by having scenes in these other points of view with other characters that are a little lighter and funny at times. So we get a break from Gary and Irene. But Gary and Irene, each scene, I think of it as conflict between them, each scene leading into the next scene, so that each scene becomes inevitable for who they are. They're essentially out of control and acting unconsciously, and they're breaking. We're finding out who they are as the pressure increases on them, and that's just like a play. That's what happens on stage.
When you're creating characters, I know that, you know, one of the big discussions I have with a number of writers is the characters take over, they become real, and some people say, ah, that's a load of crap. How do you view that? I mean, how conscious are you? How much are you molding any particular story? And if you're not molding it, what the hell is going on?
Each day, I don't know what the characters are going to do or say, and so it's a surprise, and it's about momentum, about sitting down every day, 7 days a week, that the pages before end up having pressure on what's going to happen in the two new pages today. I have some sense of who the characters are, but they do keep surprising me and saying different stuff. And it actually was only 6 months after finishing the book that I realized that all of the characters are me. And I know that's a really obvious thing that I should have understood before, but I didn't. I didn't understand, for instance, that I was Irene and that a lot of her feelings about Gary are my feelings about the men in my family. And I hadn't realized that until about 6 months after I'd finished it. So it really is a largely unconscious process in that way. As I said, I didn't know I'd be reflecting so much on marriage. And that was kind of frightening because I'm happily married. And here's this really grim view of marriage in this book. So where's that coming from?
Well, David Vann, the other element which I noticed by the end of the book is the women all come across well and all of the men come across badly.
I've been accused of that before. I had kind of bad experiences with men in my family. My dad's suicide and his father just getting more and more bitter and refusing to talk to anyone after my dad's death. On the other side of the family, my grandfather beating my grandmother and that leading to an awful legacy for everyone in the family. And I was in a lot of feminist thought workshops with Audrian Rich, and I studied creative writing with Grace Paley. And I grew up mostly with women in my family because the men mostly disappeared. So I ended up, at one point, there were 11 single women in my family, and they were all telling me the stories of all the awful encounters they'd had with men. So that was kind of my natural point of view, I think. And I think I do see the world through feminism. I think that feminist analysis is worthwhile and great and a clear way to see the world most of the time. So that is just kind of the way I see things. But I also tried to have sympathy for all the men, and all the men are me in there also. I'm Gary, and all of his impatience and his failures and his terrible attempt at building the cabin and his vacancy and the fact that he's kind of not there in some ways, like that's me also. And Carl, the young bumbling guy who's just kind of funny because he's in Alaska and he's out of his element and he hasn't even seen a bear yet and can't figure out how to do anything, like that was me when I was returning to Alaska after having been away for a long time. And so I think there's sympathy for all the male characters. I actually like all of them in there.
The character of Carl is kind of interesting because I think in terms of the broader picture, you could have cut most of him out.
It's true. Carl actually is not necessary for the dramatic action in the book. The scenes where he's in the cannery or out on a commercial fishing boat, we don't have to have to understand the story between Gary and Irene. But I wanted the reader to have a little break and get to enjoy Alaska and get to go out on a commercial fishing boat and get to see what it's like in a cannery. And I wanted the book also to have a wider range, to be talking about the idea of Alaska and what Alaska is, because that's part of what Gary's problem is that he's gone to Alaska as a kind of escape and trying to find something, and it's something that you can't find. There is no idea of Alaska. It turns out wilderness has no meaning on its own, and Alaska doesn't mean anything at all. It just means what people bring to it.
There's a quote that you gave in an interview: Alaska provides a mirror of the national imagination. Into that void we implant our dreams.
That's true, and I think that we need that. I think we need wilderness. I think it's part of the American identity historically to imagine this wilderness and imagine our resourcefulness and our goodness also as we go into that wilderness and we make a life and forge our new path. And so Gary imagines something like that, but of course all he finds is himself. Wilderness is just a mirror. And so he finds a place that's terrifying and that's empty and that is not fulfilling, that he's not so happy with.
The Gary of Caribou Island and the Jim of Sukwan Island have all of this in common. And then, of course, there's a Jim who is kind of the creepy dentist, your dad.
Right. I had a lot of fun writing my dad into Caribou Island because he just has this light, funny role where he's engaged to Rhoda, but he's distracted by this woman who visits who's half his age, and he decides in the end that he's just going to devote his life to sex, like just the most crass kind of evaluation possible at the end. And it was really fun to have my dad just be a light, comedic, like philandering character who doesn't have a son and is not heading with despair towards suicide, and it wasn't this heavy thing. And it was fun to give him a cameo role.
But you also made sure that the names Rhoda and Jim, and in fact in Legend of a Suicide, the Roy of Sukwan Island, the son, is not the same Roy of the other stories.
Mm-hmm.
You're reusing names and kind of personalities, but they're all a little different, which I've never seen before.
Yeah, to me, it's that idea again that there's no one story or one true story, and that everyone in my family has a different version of things. And also, I don't think there's one self for any of us. I think we have different versions of ourselves at different times. And I think when we get into trouble and feel despair is when we can't get those selves to match up and to make sense, and we can't make some through line, some narrative that can bring our lives together. And so that's the problem that Irene is running into at the end. She can't get those different selves to fit together. In the writing, I'm coming at my family stories different ways at different times, but I want to use the real names, the real name of my father, and then this fictional name for my stepmother, Rhoda, that occurs both in Legend of a Suicide and in Caribou Island, because I want that marker there that this is her parents' story in Caribou Island, and she was the stepmother in Legend of a Suicide, and I want that connection to be made. She's a completely different person in the two characters, but both of those are possible versions of who she is in real life.
And her name is not Rhoda.
And her name is not Rhoda in real life.
My father's name was Jim.
My father's name is Jim. Since he's dead, he gets the real name in all the books. He gets no shelter.
A couple of other areas I'd like to talk to you about in the remaining time. First, Alaska, because Alaska has entered our consciousness through Sarah Palin. But when you see Sarah Palin, you don't see Alaska.
Again, Alaska and wilderness don't have their own inherent meaning. And so what Sarah Palin has done in her TV show recently is to try to map her disgusting form of hypocritical family values onto Alaska and say that that's what Alaska is. While we have this weird kitten music playing in the background and she's saying disgusting things in the foreground. And that's not Alaska at all. And I really resent that she's taken the state and tried to co-opt it and make it mean that, because it doesn't mean that.
And Wasilla, you said, has nothing to do with Alaska.
Yeah, it's great that she actually comes from the most soulless place in all of Alaska. Wasilla is just a stop on the freeway between Anchorage and Fairbanks that has just become a strip mall with big, like, chain stores moving in and parking lots. It's just a place that people from surrounding areas go to shop. And that seems so perfect as the place that she'd be from in Alaska, a place with no character of its own.
David Vann, are you working on a book called Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter?
It's actually finished and coming out in October, and it's a nonfiction true story of the school shooting at Northern Illinois University on Valentine's Day in February 2008. I investigated it for Esquire magazine, and I was the only reporter to get the full 1,500 pages of all the police files. So I have all of his emails, his phone records, his mental health history, his military history, school history, everything. And so it's the most complete portrait that we have of a school shooter. And it's coming out again from a small university press because no one thought that anyone would want this book or that it could sell any copies. So I sent it to a contest again, Associated Writing Programs, their nonfiction award, and was lucky that it won that. So it comes out with University of Georgia Press in October. It was amazing to write because I wanted to keep this guy close and not make him a monster. So I ended up writing memoir along with it. So half the book is memoir and half of it is the story of the mass murderer. And that was very strange, to write my memoir alongside the story of a mass murderer.
Had you finished Caribou Island? Or
I wrote Last Day on Earth first.
Oh.
And I wrote it in just 7 weeks. It was in 2008 that I wrote it, when I wrote the story for Esquire magazine. I'd had 3 months of being involved in the story and all the interviews and all the files, and had all these files basically memorized. It was this terrible immersion in this really dark, awful story. And I'll never go do a story like that again. But then it wrote really quickly. I wrote it in 7 weeks because it was just all this stuff in my head, and I wanted it out of my head, and I wanted to leave that place.
Did any of it seep into Caribou?
I don't know. I think that thinking about who Irene is and how she could cross the line and think about the possibility of killing someone else, I think that that was informed by everything I'd learned about the school shooter and all of his suicide attempts before. He had about half a dozen suicide attempts, but then in the end ended up killing a bunch of students and wounding other students before killing himself. And that decision to kill other people, not just to kill himself, was something I was trying to understand in that book.
There's an article you wrote, I think last March, for Huffington Post about suicide and guns, and you're active in the anti-gun movement, I guess?
Yeah. I really think that we're insane in this country, that we don't have better controls over who can get guns. In Arizona, the shooter used the same Glock 19 pistol that the shooter at the school shooting that I wrote about used, which is also the same weapon from VA Tech. They all study each other. They all buy an enormous amount of stuff online, and that all seems to be fine. Nothing has changed since the year I was born, 1966, when the Texas Tower shooter bought an arsenal of weapons and hauled them up in a metal footlocker up the steps into the tower and started shooting people. We still have no control. It's an American right to go buy a bunch of guns and then just go and shoot a bunch of people like they're fish in a barrel. And we seem to think that that's fine, that that's okay, and that that's civilized and makes sense. We're totally insane. I just think it's ridiculous.
David Vann, are you working on two documentaries, Mexico and Vikings, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm in these documentary films because of my background as a captain,
okay.
And those have been really fun. I was in one that was an ancient Egyptian sailing ship for Nova that's called the Pharaoh's Ship, I think, that plays periodically, and I was the captain of that ship in the Red Sea. It looked like a giant wooden salad bowl from 3,500 years ago with one big rectangular sail and a couple salad spoons for rudders sailing along the Egyptian coast, and that was really fun. So now I'm doing a film for National Geographic about the Oseberg Viking ship, which is the most famous Viking relic that we have from 1,000 years ago. So I've been taking a bunch of trips to Norway to work on that. And I'll be there next week, actually, at the end of January, where I think it will be a little cold. Last time we went into the last Duke of Norway, we went into his forest and cut down a Norwegian oak for the keel. And so I'm curious to see what progress they've made now on the ship.
Well, you also spent enough time in Ketchikan, so living in a northern climb like that with darkness most mm-hmm. of the time. I mean, you do have familiarity with that.
Right, right. I like sunny beaches and such, but I have spent a lot of time in the cold northlands, and I do find them incredibly beautiful and suggestive. I mean, just in Alaska, the color of the blue sky when there's almost no sunlight there in the winter is pretty amazing.
We have this vision of Alaska as this right-wing place where people smoke pot and get drunk, and you said, no, it's right and left-wing.
Yeah, everyone there smokes pot pretty much that I met, from the far left and the far right. That's one thing they have in common. And the other thing they have in common is that they don't really like the government keeping track of them, and they tend to, you know, head off into the wilderness and have their houses kind of out of view. But there are a lot of people on the left in Alaska, a lot of very progressive people, you know, who are pot smoking and commercial fishermen, and then plenty of people who don't smoke pot and teachers and such. And then there are a lot of people from the right. And the U.S. generally is polarized, but I think the Alaska has always been more polarized. It's always been a place that's attracted people from both ends of the political spectrum and not a whole lot of people that would be in the middle.
Well, would you recommend a college student going up during the summer and doing the fishing and cannery biz, or would you not?
It's a great adventure, and I did it. I went up there. It's hard work. The only reason you make a bunch of money is that you work 16 days a week at this terrible, cold, slime-lime job ripping guts out of fish. So it's pure suffering. You live in a tent camp, and it rains on you most of the time, and there are mosquitoes. It's much better to go to Alaska as a tourist for a couple weeks and enjoy going around and seeing stuff.
The character of Roy in Sukwan Island, he just puts a couple of lines in the water, and suddenly, I didn't know what a Dolly Varden was, but it's a kind of trout. Do the fish just pop out of the water like that?
They used to. When I was a kid in Kodiak, I would cast only six times to get my limit of six salmon. The river would have them, so it would be so full of salmon that they were bumping into each other and actually knocking each other up out of the water. The surface would be roiling with fish bodies. I mean, it was just solid. And so you'd cast six times, and you wouldn't even get the lure to come all the way back across the water toward you. It would only be in the water for a couple feet before it would get hit. That's the way I grew up. It was an amazing Alaska. We would pull a boat into a cove and look down and just see hundreds of salmon. And my grandfather caught a 250-pound halibut that's just enormous. But those times have changed. Those were the 70s. And now you can go there and fish for a long time, and if you don't know what you're doing, you won't catch anything.
So it's really changed. The sea has been fished out.
Yeah, everywhere in the world we're fishing it out. I mean, and in Alaska, if you go out with a guide, you can still catch big fish and catch them reliably. But if you go yourself, you most likely won't catch a thing.
A couple of quick questions because we're out of time. First of all, the relation of memoir and autobiography and fiction, which is what your work is about, should we be concerned about putting a word on it, a memoir, an autobiography? How should we think in terms of fiction and nonfiction?
The only rule I have is that if I change characters or events, then I call it fiction instead of nonfiction. I feel that I have to be true to not make up any people or make up what happened when I'm writing nonfiction. But, of course, nonfiction is incredibly artificial, and the idea that it's somehow a true story is ludicrous. We're making a narrative. We're telling the story one way when it could have been told 50 other ways. We're trying to recreate dialogue, often from years before. And so the idea that memoir is somehow true and that whole stink about a million little pieces, that's just stupid, that whole discussion. Like, what are readers thinking? Like, of course it's all made up. All of history is made up. Everything in nonfiction is really fiction. But just that rule of not making up characters or events, I think if writers follow that, that's good enough. So in Caribou Island, it's powered by true family stories, but it's been transformed. It's in a new place, and everything has been changed. And so really it is fiction. I'm more interested in the stories that writers have to tell, whether they're telling fiction or nonfiction. We have so many lies in our media all the time, pundits who are pretending to say the truth, and they're just saying outrageous lies, that we're just a culture of big lies. And so I don't know why we're expecting truth anywhere.
David Vann, what are you working on now?
I have a new novel titled Dirt that I'm finishing up that is set in 1985 New Age California. It's set in a walnut orchard in Carmichael in Sacramento and then up in the Sierras.
Are there any of your characters reappearing?
No characters are reappearing. Entirely different and working from the other side of the family.
You've been listening to an interview with David Vann, whose latest novel is Caribou Island. Sukhwan Island is available for free to download. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.